Welcome to Nightlights. I'm David Brent Johnson. In 1954, pianist Bud Powell turned 30, and the damage of hospitalizations, an excessive work schedule, and other strains and traumas of recent years began to take a toll on his playing. For the last 12 years of his life, Powell would be intermittently brilliant, and we'll hear some of those musical moments in the next hour, along with commentary from Peter Pullman, author of the Powell biography, Whale. It's The Scene Changes, The Life and Music of Bud Powell, Part 2. Coming up next on Nightlights. Pianist Bud Powell performing Lady Bird, recorded on April 27, 1955, with George DeVivier on bass and Art Taylor on drums, from The Best of Bud Powell on Verve. Lady Bird, a tune written by Tad Dameron, and one that went on to become a jazz standard recorded by Miles Davis, Dexter Gordon, and many others. As 1954 began, pianist Bud Powell, aged 29, the leading light of bebop piano, found himself in unfamiliar territory, booked by his manager Oscar Goodstein to play a club in Los Angeles, on the other side of the country from his home base of New York City, and also suddenly no longer in command of the genius and talent that had driven his playing from childhood on. From now on, the recordings that he made would range from mediocre and disoriented to brilliant, but he could no longer sustain the level of achievement that he'd attained throughout his 20s. Hospitalizations, a grinding 1953 work schedule, and growing problems with substance abuse all contributed to the erratic quality that accompanies Powell's discography from 1954 to the end of his life, as Peter Pullman, author of the Powell biography Whale, observes.
What happened? How could somebody – he's still playing very well in 53. It's not 1949, but, you know, he'd been through a lot. And then 1954, it's almost unrecognizable. I don't know, but I think that Powell was kept so busy in 53, and Bud Powell personally was very pliable. He was very suggestible. He was, you might say, from the moment he left the bandstand, he was very weak-willed. I don't think there's any getting away, and I base that on everything that people told me from partners of his and friends and managers and everybody says the same thing. He was on the bandstand. He was the boss. Nobody, not even Charlie Parker, could tell him what tune to play or how to play it. But off the bandstand, he was weak. And Goodstein stupidly got him a gig in California for the first week. I think he was supposed to open on a Friday, January 4th, something like that, in Los Angeles, at a club that was not well suited to modern jazz. And suddenly, Powell crashed. And from 54 and all the work he had in 53 constantly in the clubs and a number of record dates, suddenly 54 is a complete void. And Goodstein, who was furious at him for the failure in Los Angeles, and I give all the reasons why, I make excuses for Powell. It was alien territory to him, strange club and so far from home and from everything he knew. But when he found out there, Goodstein said, and it's been quoted in court papers, "I wash my hands of that guy. I want nothing to do with him anymore." Well, it was Goodstein that had kept him going. It was Goodstein who got him all the work. And at 54, there's no work. So suddenly Powell looks down and sees an abyss, and he plummets. So the two record dates he did in 54 are very isolated events. You ask any musician in that era, it was all about staying busy. It was all about staying active. The more you played, the more people you played with, the more ideas you heard, the more inspired. Yeah, you could be tired and you needed to cool down and you needed someone to look after you. It's tiring. It's a tough life. But you don't want to stop working. No musician wants to stop working. Powell was in a kind of forced retirement. And so suddenly, 6 months after his last gig, he gets into a studio. Hey, that's a long time to be off when you've been playing nightly with the greatest talents in the world, you know, for years. And then suddenly what? But the same thing, of course, when he's in the hospital, suddenly everything stopped. And I guess as Powell got older, those enforced arrests or those enforced hiatuses were harder to recover from.
Bud Powell performing Star Eyes in 1955 with George DeVivier on bass and Art Taylor on drums, and It Never Entered My Mind before that in 1954 with Percy Heath on bass and Taylor again on drums, both from the Best of Bud Powell on Verve, recorded for Norman Granz's label. Powell also recorded for RCA in the mid-1950s and for Blue Note Records as well, the label that had given birth to some of his greatest musical triumphs between 1949 and 1953. Peter Pullman says the return to Blue Note also gave rise to some of Powell's best work from this period.
The Blue Note stuff is good because he enjoyed Alfred Lion. Alfred Lion understood something about psychology that Norman Granz didn't, and he knew that if he treated Powell with respect and gave Powell what he wanted, which usually meant like a lunch and obviously a beer, you know, which Powell shouldn't have had, but it did make him happy to have a drink. Lion showed him respect, and then, you know, he knew now, get him to the studio. He's well fed. He had his one beer that he was allotted, and he wanted to play. And of course, Lion also, you know, famously paid musicians for rehearsals. So the dates for Lion and Blue Note are pretty good. And the best tune that he wrote in that whole period was done at the last date, which was the very end of December 58, Cleopatra's Dream. I think it's a marvelous tune. It's got the complexity. It's got some of the bop influence. It's I think, a great Powell composition, and yet you hardly hear musicians covering it these days.
Thank you.
Bud Powell in 1958 performing his composition Cleopatra's Dream with Paul Chambers on bass and Art Taylor on drums from the album The Scene Changes. I'll have more of the music of Bud Powell and Powell biographer Peter Pullman's commentary in just a few moments. You can listen to this and previous Nightlights programs, including Time Flies, Bud Powell Part 1, and Burning with Bud Powell Live, 1944 through 1953, on our website at indianapublicmedia.org/nightlights. Production support for Nightlights comes from Landlocked Music CDs and Vinyl, located at 202 North Walnut in Bloomington, or online at landlockedmusic.com, and from the Laughing Planet Cafe at the corner of Kirkwood and Grant in Bloomington. Carry out and delivery information at 812-323-2233. I'm David Brent Johnson, and you're listening to The Scene Changes, The Life and Music of Bud Powell, Part 2, on Nightlights. Featuring the late period music of pianist Bud Powell on this edition of Nightlights, along with commentary from Peter Pullman, author of the Powell biography Whale, which can be purchased at the website whalethelifeofbudpowell.com or as a Kindle edition on Amazon. In 1959, Powell and Altiva Edwards, the woman also known as Buttercup, who had become his companion, went to France, little knowing that they were beginning a new and significant chapter in Powell's life.
I think it's indicative of Bud Powell's personality, and maybe even of his character, if that's something deeper, that when he went to Paris in April 1959, it was at the invitation of Blue Note, the Right Bank prestigious club. And he didn't know whether this was just a few weeks engagement or whether it might lead to something more. He was asked by a journalist, and he didn't know. Bud Powell was not completely in control of himself, of his person. And the opportunity to play in Paris was more to do with having work than it was the lure of Paris, France more generally, and Europe with its very different milieu. It's different. People have different manners, a different way of presenting jazz, and a different kind of clientele that goes to jazz clubs. Powell didn't know any of that. He had been before on a tour, but when he went, it was a gig, and it was because he wasn't working in the States. It was only toward the end of his time there that people had expressed enthusiasm for his playing, had taken an interest in him personally, and so they went, he and his minder went month to month, just figuring, well, we'll stay as long as there's work. It wound up being 5.5 years.
Some of Powell's finest performances from this period come in the company of familiar American colleagues who appeared with him or invited him to sit in, such as Coleman Hawkins and Art Blakey. Here he is in 1960 with Charles Mingus doing I'll Remember April on Nightlights. Thank you. Bud Powell in 1960, sitting in with Charles Mingus' group at the Antibes Jazz Festival in France, doing I'll Remember April. Throughout his first several years in Paris, Powell often performed in a trio setting with bebop colleague Kenny Clark on drums and a young Pierre Michelot on bass. The group called themselves the Three Bosses and appeared frequently at Club Blue Note in Paris. Here they are doing a Powell composition that was a staple of his repertoire at the time, John's Abbey on Nightlights. Bud Powell, bassist Pierre Michelot, and drummer Kenny Clark performing Powell's composition John's Abbey, recorded at Club Blue Note in Paris in June of 1960. Peter Pullman on the quality of Powell's playing his first several years in Europe.
There's an old expression, the mind limps along after reality. And in Powell's case, he was so talented, he was such a great musician, that long after his physical self had deteriorated, and, you know, you can't get away from the alcoholism, that's a major part of it. But, you know, even the onset of other problems, he dabbled with heroin. But even when his body deteriorated, his mind, his musical mind, still functioned extremely well. He was playing extremely well in Copenhagen in 1962, and that's borne out by a wonderful recording, Bud Powell Trio. It's here available on Delmark. You can hear it's with Niels Henning Ørsted Pedersen, and you can hear he is still great. He's still playing beautifully. Thank you.
Bud Powell performing Benny Golson's I Remember Clifford in Copenhagen in 1962 with Niels Henning Ørsted Petersen on bass and William Schopf on drums from the album Bouncing with Bud. It was at the end of 1962 that Powell formed what would prove to be the most significant relationship of his final years with a young French commercial artist and devoted Powell fan named Francis Poudros.
Somebody who was such a positive force in Bud Powell's life, who truly loved Bud Powell as maybe no one else did. Now, others tried, women tried, but he was not equipped to have a long-standing love relationship. But Francis Poudros loved him. And in December 1962, Powell, who was not working steadily then in Paris, he had in 59 and even in 60, but in early 61, he was fired from his job at Blue Note. And in 62, he worked in Denmark, which was very receptive to him, Copenhagen, and he worked at Norway as well, in Sweden. But at the end of 62, he wasn't working. And as had happened, unfortunately, too many times, and this had happened in New York too, Bud Powell just found his way free of his minder and got drunk and passed out in the street. And somebody found him, not Poudros, and took him to a hospital. When Poudros was contacted by Altivia Edwards, who was at wit's end because she didn't speak French and she didn't know where Bud Powell was, Poudros went on a hunt to find him, found him in a hospital, and signed for his release. Now, he didn't take over the care of Bud Powell immediately because Edwards still had control, but that was the beginning of the relationship. And by the summer of 63, Poudros noticed that Powell had the signs of tuberculosis. He didn't know at first what it was. He knew Powell was sick. And to show how abusive the relationship was with Altivia Edwards, she denied it and did not want Powell to get treatment. Poudros insisted, took him to the hospital, found that he had tuberculosis, and arranged for his cure. And from the time of Powell's release from the hospital and his admittance to a sanatorium in the fall of 63 to begin his treatments, you know, outpatient, not outpatient, but his sanatorium treatments, Poudros was in control. When Powell was released from a sanatorium, it was in Poudros's care, and he lived with Poudros in his Paris apartment.
Under Francis Poudras' care, Powell began to regain his health and even to compose some new music.
By the onset of the tuberculosis in mid-63, it's clear that everything was breaking down. But with Poudras' help and the cure at the sanatorium, when he was released, he managed to play a decent record date in July of 64. It's the last record date you can say is decent. There's a couple of fairly brightly tempoed tunes on it and a couple of originals. Not that they're great, but, you know, that Bud Powell was writing anything. And that you owe, that session, July 31st of 64, done in Paris, you owe to Poudras and his ministrations. So, yeah, you know, even when things, Bud was deteriorating and he was only 2 years from his death in July of 64, he was still capable of playing a good record date.
Here's something from that date that Bud Powell wrote in tribute to his new caretaker, Una Noche con Francis, on Nightlights. Bud Powell and Una Noche con Francis from the CD Blues for Buffalmont. Shortly after that record date was made, Powell returned to New York City for the first time in 5 years, accompanied by Poldros, and booked to play a series of gigs at Birdland, where he had so often held court before. Peter Pullman says Powell, in spite of his renewed good health and comfortable life in Paris, had a longing to go back to his hometown.
I don't think he'd be human if he didn't have some strong hankering for the old friends, the old scene, not only the good people, you know, who loved him no matter how badly he played or how well he played, but the hangers-on, you know, the fans. Some of them were good for him. Some of them treated him to too many drinks or maybe to some heroin or whatever. But he hankered for all of it. Poldros recognized that, and when Poldros had received letters from Oscar Goodstein, who at this point was the majority owner of Birdland, he had been the manager, the night manager, and Goodstein wrote letters to Poldros thanking him for rescuing Powell from Altivia Edwards and rescuing him from tuberculosis, and he offered him. And I think Goodstein hankered to see Bud again. Bud hankered to see the old crowd, the old people, Birdland, the whole scene, and Harlem, too, which was Powell's birthplace. And I think Poldros, for getting the credit for bringing him back and reuniting him with everybody in the New York scene, he also should take some of the blame, because I think Poldros had stars in his eyes. And I think Poldros recognized that if he brought Bud Powell back to New York and reunited him with the old gang, with Monk, with the Sidemen who loved playing with Bud, with the fans, as I said, that he would get some credit, and he'd be recognized as the man who saved Bud Powell.
The return proved to be disastrous. Though Powell received a warm welcome from many of his admirers and jazz colleagues when he opened at Birdland, reviews of his performances were mixed, and as time went on, he began to fail to show up for sets, and his playing, when he did show up, showed marked signs of deterioration from an already shaky standard. Francis Poldros returned to France in late 1964 alone. Bud Powell, after a handful of unsuccessful concert appearances and attempts to make new recordings, withdrew completely from the jazz scene, staying with his daughter Celia and her mother, Mary Frances Barnes, in their Brooklyn apartment. He died on July 31, 1966, at the age of 41. Thousands of people came out in Harlem for his funeral procession, which featured pianist Barry Harris, trumpeter Lee Morgan, and other jazz artists of note playing atop the Jazzmobile. Though Powell was gone, his recordings, both studio and live, would live on and continue to influence generations of jazz pianists to come. And the story of his years in Europe would serve in part as inspiration for the 1986 movie Round Midnight. What can never be recaptured, even though we can experience it from a distance on those live recordings, is the thrill of hearing Bud Powell in person.
What I try to do in my book is convey the excitement that people felt when they sat sometimes inches away from the piano and watched him play. Every time Bud returned to a nightclub to play three or four sets a night, six or seven nights a week, and sometimes for 3 or 4 weeks, that's a lot of hard work, you know. Every time he did that, I had somebody tell me who had been there what it was like. And sometimes words failed them. It was so exciting. Johnny Griffin, a musician, said, you know, watching him play, the hair on the back of my neck stood up. You know, I had many people try to find the words for it. Bud Powell's legacy was in the thrill of what he did when he sat down at the piano. And I think it's linked to one of the major themes of my work, which is the will he had to play, that drive, that urge. You know, he entered a room, and if he saw a piano, it didn't matter if someone was sitting at it or not. He charged the piano stool, shoved the guy off the bench, and sat down to play. And I think if there are musicians today who have that same urge, that same will, they just can't help themselves. They just gotta play, you know? And they gotta grab their instrument, and they gotta play with everything they have until they're told to stop, and even then, sometimes they don't. I think that's Bud Powell's legacy. That determination to overcome obstacles, and music first, last, and always. And that's what he was, to his detriment, because he didn't take care of his personal life. Some people described him like a music machine, and when he played a club, the club manager wound him up every night, you know, to get him to play so that the patrons came in and then bought drinks and made money for the club. And then at the end of the night, Bud Powell, like a machine, wound down, and then, you know, he had to try to live a life, and he wasn't very good at that. But that drive and that urge to play with everything you've got and to give every improvisation, all of your creative energy and all of your soul. That's what Bud Powell was. And I, you know, it's up to the listeners to say, well, I hear that in so-and-so, or, you know, so-and-so's my favorite musician because I've seen him. And every time I do, it's a new thrill. I know he's going to give it everything he's got. And that's what Bud Powell's legacy is.
I closed with Bud Powell performing Just One of Those Things from the CD Lausanne 1962. Thanks for tuning in this edition of Nightlights. Special thanks to Peter Pullman, whose biography of Bud Powell, Whale, can be purchased at whalethelifeofbudpowell.com or as a Kindle edition through Amazon. You can listen to this and previous Nightlights programs, including Time Flies, Bud Powell Part 1, and Burning with Bud, Bud Powell Live, 1944 through 1953, on our website at indianapublicmedia.org/nightlights. Production support for Nightlights comes from Landlocked Music CDs and Vinyl, and from the Laughing Planet Cafe at the corner of Kirkwood and Grant in Bloomington. Nightlights is a production of WFIU and part of the educational mission of Indiana University. I'm David Brent Johnson, wishing you good listening for the week ahead.